Part 5. Patient Again. After dramatic days of consultation in doctors' offices and long discussions in Bengali, the news broke that Swami was at last resigned to have the cataracts removed here. Once he had decided, he did not look back. Yet one felt he was disappointed not to be able to demonstrate to his friends that his unoperated eyes would last as long as the rest of him. Much of his thought before re-entering the hospital was given to the various possible routes back to India, and it was plain that he had enough of this country. He had me bring him several airline schedules, and he loved to pore over these, making alternative flight plans with due consideration for the respective weather conditions, and so on. In the second week of December, he moved back to the 16th floor of New York Cornell Hospital. Instead of his former room, not now available, he took a smaller one with no fine view. Since he would be able to see little this time, it was not important. Also, the male nurses who had attended him were unavailable now. Fortunately, two excellent women on private duty were found for the day shifts. Swami had become accustomed to the attendance of women nurses, and he made a good friend of the evening nurse, a lady well along in years with a heart of gold. It also meant I was able to serve him in more ways than had previously been possible. Swami's eye operations were separated by a 3-day interval, as was common with cataracts in those days. He returned from the second operation full of fun and talking so freely that we were all surprised. It may have been partially the lingering effect of medications, but possibly he was happy that these operations had been easier than he had anticipated. His conversation that afternoon was like hearing someone read from Finnegan's Wake. Thus arrived, for Swami Madhavananda, the period in which he could not read a line for himself and had to depend on the eyes of others. In the mornings, I read him the daily paper. He seldom wished to go deeply into details. We would skip from column to column as it held his interest. But unlike many older persons who have to be read to, Swami never fell asleep, leaving the reader dangling and embarrassed as to his next move. When he slept, he slept. When he listened, he was attentive, even if he made no comment at all. At other times, his favorite was the Reader's Digest. Together, we would read the articles in an order dictated by his relative interest in the topics. Sometimes, until the whole issue was exhausted, even though the subjects of the last few articles might stir no flicker of familiarity in his mind. Probably a principle was involved, finishing what has been started. Swami had a Victorian approach to humor, no doubt, yet not without sophistication, and he wanted to hear every amusing remark in the digest. Whether the idioms were beyond his ken or not, he would be very much moved by the tragedies, something I really hadn't expected. Only a few weeks earlier, there had occurred the tragic accident taking the life of Dag Hammarskjöld. The journal published a verse which had been found inserted in his family Bible. This is the verse. Everyone comes into the world crying while others laugh. One should live so that when he leaves the world, others may cry, but he will laugh. That is Indian, I said to Swami. Yes, it comes from Tulsidas, said he. How typical of the Western publishers not to acknowledge its Oriental source. That does not matter at all, was Swami Madhavananda's reaction. There was an article about the Bible itself, and Swami gave his opinion. The new translations may have made many things more clear, small things mostly, but they have made a hash of all the passages we have taken the trouble to memorize. I could only agree. He referred to the Indian Puranas as religious novels. He liked mysteries, cared least for the science articles unless they were medical, like those of Paul de Kreef, and was fond of success stories. We read about the many ways in which Henry Ford had utilized the soybean, and about John Alexander MacDonald, the builder of the Canadian nation. These he very much appreciated. He was not yet ready for the heavier diet of the holy books and periodicals of the Ramakrishna order, although he did sometimes read or have read to him his Bengali Kathamrita, the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. But he was finding divinity, I am sure, in whatever came to him, sacred or secular. Sometimes I venture to suggest that an article we propose to read might not be as innocent in tone or content as monks would like. He would say, "You are reading for me, not for yourself," like Swamiji reading the Ashtavakra Sanghita to the master. One of the book supplements was the true story of Elsa, the lioness, tamed and raised as their child by the Adamsons who lived in Africa. This is an engrossing story told in a graphic way, and it moved him, one could see. The next book condensation in the Reader's Digest was the biography of Ishi, the last wild Indian in North America. The despicable capture by ignorant men of Ishi, a Yana Indian of Central California, is offset in the chronicles of California history only by his subsequent delivery into the hands of a loving and appreciative anthropologist, who saw to it that Ishi was given kind care for life as the ward of a university department. He lived many years thereafter in a museum and led a very happy life, freely demonstrating not only the skills and crafts of the Indians, but also their admirable attitudes and philosophy of life. His character, as revealed in the friendships he made and in his simple pleasures and austere life, was remarkable and memorable. It showed a kinship in character between the Indians of our continent and those properly called Indians in the East. Swami did not miss one word of it, telling me afterward how inspiring he had found it. "Much better than the lioness story," he said. And he said that Ishi was a real man. Several years later, I happened to visit another Indian museum in Sacramento, where an entire room is set aside for pictures of Ishi, as well as artifacts and souvenirs left behind him or otherwise relating to his story. I wrote about it to Swami, who was then president of the order. He replied that he well remembered Ishi, and was much gratified to know about his room. On one of the days just after the cataract operations, when Swami was asked to lie very still in his hospital bed, there came to his mind an old conundrum of the anagram type which he asked me to try to solve. I worked on it, going to and fro in the city buses. Only after 2 days did I have it. Moreover, it is doubtful that I would have solved it at all had he not made one slip of the tongue while explaining the puzzle, thus revealing one of the words. This puzzle is given at the end of this chapter. It seemed to be Swami's delight to entertain those who were supposed to be entertaining him. He told me the story of a man in Bengal who had a very sensitive conscience. We would probably refer to him today as a wimp. This fellow was walking on a Calcutta street when a stranger stopped him and asked, "Sir, can you tell me the way to the Star Theatre?" Our friend was prudish in such matters and thoroughly disapproved of the theatre. "No, I don't know," he said. After he had proceeded a few steps, the thought occurred to him that he had told a lie. Better go back and rectify it. So he ran back after the stranger, and finally catching up with him said, "Yes, I know where the Star Theatre is, but I'm not willing to tell you." I believe it was the same man who was once taking a train trip with his young son, when suddenly, about midday, he caught hold of a conductor who was passing through the train. "Look here, my good fellow," pulling out his own watch, "I now owe you another half fare. My son has just passed 12 years of age." The first time this fellow traveled by train, he had bought 2 tickets. One for himself and one for his daughter. Seeing the notice on the tickets, non-transferable, he had run back to ask the agent, "Oh, see here, now which ticket is for me and which for my daughter?" It was not possible for me to stay in the hospital at night. Swami had to depend on the services of Miss B, his evening nurse, there being no alternative. She had been given the impossible instructions that no woman was to touch the Swami. On the first day, finding him covered with perspiration, she set everything else aside and followed her nursing instincts. Getting up from her chair, she said, "Look, Swami, let's forget now that I am a woman and you are a Swami, and let me make you comfortable." She then helped him to bathe, to change his gown and bedsheets, and did all she could for him. When she had finished, Swami gave her just a grateful pat on the back of her hand. This became, she told me, his invariable thank you for her services, from that time forth. She said she considered it the dearest kind of blessing. In whatever she did around his person, she was most careful always to let him preserve his modesty completely. When about to leave the hospital, Swami wanted to give Miss B a gift. She said, "No king or queen could have been presented with a fortune in a more dignified manner." "Miss B," said Swami Madhavananda, "I wish to present you with something." "Oh, Swami," said she, "you don't need to present me with anything. But it is Christmas time." "I know, Swami, but no, I wish to present this to you." And he gave her a package. She preferred to open presents at home when off duty. "No," he insisted, "she must open it then and there." Well, it proved to be a box of candy in the shape of a book. When she came the next day, she told him, "That was a very sweet book, Swami, and he laughed a lot at this. I asked Miss B what she thought was the most impressive thing about Swami Madhavananda. She replied that to her it was the fact that he was always saying his prayers. And I asked her how she knew that. She showed me how he had done japa on the joints of his fingers and said she had seen his toes move with the rhythm of it also. On my way to India 3 years later, I found that Miss B had retired to a nurse's home, and I arranged to meet her. Her memories of Swami were vivid, and it was clear that the experience of serving him had been etched into her mind. I have often wondered what her death was like. Did he come to pat her hand, perhaps?